Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. If you're listening via our new Radio Plus iPhone app, did you know you have Bloomberg Radio's complete program guide at the touch of a finger? Just slide your screen to the right and look for the green schedule icon. If you don't have the Radio Plus iPhone app yet, you'll want to download it. It's free via the iTunes App Store.
John Sylvia with us from Wells Fargo. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, sir.
A little more gloomier from your already cautious view. Is this just the knock-on from Europe, or is there something unique about the American economy slowing down?
No, I think it's a little bit of a knock-on from Europe and the continued stretching out of this whole process. I think the European situation is probably more negative for the manufacturing sector of the U.S. and typically in terms of exports. But I'll pick up on Karen's point. I mean, the price of imports have come down. I think the price of gasoline has pretty much come down for a lot of people. So the consumer may be doing a little bit better, but the overall GDP is probably 1.5 to 2% for the second half of the year.
Well, if the consumer is doing better, John, we get retail sales for May tomorrow, and our survey says down. We get it on the day after, and our survey says zero after a 0.1% increase in April.
Well, you know, of course, that would be wrong because our estimate is minus 0.2. So I think the consumers know it. I think that one number is a monthly number. But overall, you're going to see consumer adding to economic growth 2% in the second quarter when it's reported in July. So I think the consumer has that nice forward momentum. It's not a boom, though, Ken. I mean, that's the challenge. I mean, we're still expecting this economy to take off, and all we're getting is average.
Well, I think that's the important point, and you go, really, to the idea of another slowdown here. Why can't we get it going? Is it just the dampening of deleveraging, the financial system dragging economic growth, where we get 2 or 3 months or even 2 quarters pretty darn good, and then no. For 3 years.
Well, there have been some odd things happening. There is that seasonal adjustment factor problem that really does show up on a regular basis. But I would say, yes, it's the continued deleveraging for some American consumers. It's the housing sector that can't really get itself together. And it's the non-residential construction now, the construction for natural gas really has turned negative.
We're going to have to be like Sherlock Holmes. Sylvia is so irresponsible in his small font size on his Excel spreadsheet. We have to have the official surveillance magnifying glass to help us out here.
Well, John, what do you make of that Fed study that showed that between 2007 and 2010, household net worth got knocked back to the level of 1992? I mean, the way it's supposed to go is you get more prosperous as you get older, and now we've learned that we've lost 18 years worth of gains in household net worth.
And I would split that too, Ken. This is something we talk about a lot, and I'm sure you've heard about a lot. When you split household net worth and you look at the assets, it's really the real estate assets that have taken the big hit and have not started to recover. When you look at the financial assets, you'll see some recovery there. So once again, Ken, you kind of get this impression of why it is certain groups that have the financial assets behind them are seeing a better economy and some improvement, while those whose wealth is really concentrated in real estate continue to struggle.
There was that report from Fidelity a while back saying that everybody's IRA had recovered, you know, from the unpleasantness of the fall of 08.
Why is the third quarter so soggy? 1.4% is your number?
Well, for us, it is slower job growth that is impacting overall consumer income growth. We see non-residential construction subtracting from overall GDP. And Tom, I would say the one big surprise we have is business investment. That has slowed down a little bit more than we expected. We look at the capital goods orders, which you folks, of course, always review, and that suggests to us a little bit more slowdown. Part of it, of course, is the energy sector. But I think a lot of it is just the uncertainty about what exactly where is our visibility 6 months to a year ahead? And I don't see there's a lot of visibility there.
What do the politicians do to push against this spreadsheet? Is there a government program to jumpstart nominal GDP?
Well, I would say, Tom.
Paul Krugman's worn a tie like that. I mean, is Mr. Krugman right? We're going to need some stimulus?
No, I think we just need some clarity. I think you just need Congress and a president to get together and say, listen, this is what we're going to do about the payroll tax cut. This is what we're going to do about the Bush tax cut. This is what we're going to do about the estate taxes. This is what we're going to do about discretionary spending. You look at the last GDP report, and you already saw defense spending coming down pretty sharply. So people in defense sector are already starting to gear up for the cuts that they possibly anticipate coming in 2013. So no, I think you just get to, you don't need another stimulus. I think we really need is people getting together and say, here are the rules. Here's what 2013 is going to look like in terms of taxes and spending. Go for it.
Given your caution, what will the unemployment rate do?
I think it's going to stay pretty steady because now you've got it seems to be a steadiness in the participation rate. So I'm thinking 8%, 8.2% is the range for the end of the year.
8.2% politically, that's not advantageous for anybody. It sounds like a jobs program. What is the most efficient jobs program?
I think opportunity. Firms have to see that they can make profits doing something. They have to see an opportunity and pursue it. And right now, I think a lot of firms are sort of geared up for 2% growth. They don't see 2.5% or 3%, so they don't see the reason to expand. And that's why you're getting both a slowdown in investment, especially in equipment and software, and a slowdown in employment.
How important, John, is extension of the tax cuts set to expire at the end of the year?
You know, Ken, I think that the whole package, Bush tax cuts, the payroll tax cut, the discretionary spending, the, mandatory cuts in defense, all should be extended at this point. Give us some visibility and push the thing out until July, maybe next year. And I think that's the key. That's the clarity you and I were talking about just a few minutes ago.
Ken, let me cut in here to say the Spanish yield is just blown out from a 660. 2 hours ago, right now, 6.72. That's not the spread. That's the actual Spanish yield. This with the Dow up 26 points, a euro 124.81.
So is 7%, John, going to be the magic number for Spain the way it was for Ireland? And
It depends.
Is that quite how we want to put it? Is it the magic number?
The magic number. But yeah. Went up to 7, and that triggered a bailout.
Clearly in economics, no matter what country you're talking about, you cannot have the nominal yield on a 10-year treasury in excess of the nominal growth rate in the economy. That's clearly the case for Spain. It does suggest continued contraction in that economy over time.
This is an incredibly important formula. Joe Stiglitz wrote this up a while back. Say that again, John Sylvia. The top line yield of a 10-year yield, when it goes above the growth rate,
of
real GDP or nominal?
Well, you can express it either way, but most people would do nominal at this point.
Top line GDP, really important point, folks. So in the U.S., that would be 4%, and our 10-year yield is 1.6%, granted, with central bank action. But in Europe, you've got nominal GDP of, let's say it's 5%.
At best.
And the yield is 6 point whatever.
Right, that's not sustainable because very simply, in non-economies, basically, the growth in your interest rates, which interest expense, which is expressed by the interest rate, exceeds the growth in the economy's ability to pay the bills. And that's unsustainable over time. Plain and simple, no matter what country you're talking about.
It's almost, I would call it a law.
Yeah.
Would you call it a law?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, it's there. It's been around for a long time. We never thought we would really see the day that this would have become, this, as they say, this unpleasant monetarist arithmetic.
And the contagion is here. Does the contagion come over to the United States?
Well, I think certainly you've seen some of it in terms of the exports. You're going to see, I think, some tightening in terms of credit availability and spreads widening over time. I mean, it's amazing to think about how much spreads have widened recently. High-grade bonds, Tom, still seem to be very, very active market.
So there's a lot of corporate profits.
Corporate profits. And so that seems to be happening. But the high yield, sort of, reflecting a little bit of uncertainty in equities, continues to struggle a little bit.
Ken, the Dow up 42 points, 12,453. The VIX does better, 23.03.
When you look at Europe, like Tom said, Spanish 10-year notes are getting closer to 7%. Germany pays about 1.4, 1.35.
Absolutely, so, huge.
How long can that last? They've got the same currency, but you've got such a spread.
Well, I'll just pick up on the Bloomberg headline this morning about Angela Merkel. I mean, she says borrowing can't solve the problem. In the short run, yeah, you can. That can persist, but over time, you know, when the day comes that the ECB and the ESF and everybody else decides they're not going to lend any more money, the game ends. And it's only because of the liquidity that's being created. As many people have speculated, for example, in Spain, who was buying all the Spanish debt? Spanish banks. You know, the
under pressure from the government.
Yeah, probably, there doesn't seem to be a private sector market. You know, for an economist, generally you want to see a willing buyer and a willing seller in a marketplace. That defines the market. Here, we've got governments doing all the work. There's no willing buyer and willing seller in a private sector.
Well, how does that go with what you hear over here sometimes, just saying government debt doesn't matter because we owe it to ourselves?
Well, of course we don't. We owe a lot to the Japanese and the Chinese and somebody in London, we're not sure who, because London's just a financial trading hub. No, we owe a lot of our debt to foreigners.
Why are we afraid to clear the markets? I think the fossildom, John Tucker being the young lad in the room, but the fossildom here.
Don't insult our guests like that.
Remembers Continental Illinois and other debacles. DeLong and Eichengreen writing the new preface to Kindleberger on panics and crashes. We've been here, and you clear markets, and you start over. Why are we having such trouble doing that?
Because I think, one, we don't have a good model to estimate what the short-run negative impact's going to be. People fear that there's a cumulative process on the negative impact. And so we don't want to see this huge downside, so we do a lot of Band-Aids trying to buy ourselves time so to let the market work out over time. But again, as you can suspect, let's go back to the monetarist arithmetic. If you don't have the growth, there's no way you can pay the bills. And no matter how many Band-Aids you throw at it, no matter how much money you throw at it, the reality is you don't have the growth to pay the bills. And that was the Greek story, and that's a challenge for us in America.
Will it be the Italy story?
Well, Italy doesn't have the growth either, so they're going to be challenged as well. And, you know, how much money can we put out there to do this? But that's a challenge in the United States. You know, do we have, instead of issuing more and more deficits and more debt to the future, are we going to be able to just grow? And right now, Tom, it's the challenge of there's a lack of growth. 2% isn't doing it, pal.
Well, it's almost, should our corporations run the economy? Because the great bright light here has been corporate profits, granted on a multinational basis.
That I think is key, and is something we've all talked about before. A significant share of U.S. profits is, in fact, earned abroad as corporations do become multinational and focus on many different opportunities across the globe.
When Secretary Clinton, as candidate Clinton, talked about fair trade, can we dovetail better trade into the corporate success story? If we take transnational corporations and they mint money, can we somehow get them to circuitously create American jobs?
Oh, certainly. The trick, of course, is how you define fair trade. Trade in general does improve the general welfare of the overall economy. There are going to be losers no matter what you do. It's the high-cost producer that loses. It's the employees in the high-cost industry. And we look at this in terms of shoes or textiles. But in general, open trade, freer trade, does improve the overall strength of the U.S. economy.
Are we in a manufacturing renaissance? Or well, does it get derailed with this European foolishness?
No, I think, quite frankly, Tom, I think the manufacturing renaissance that's going on, I do believe there is a renaissance, is generated through productivity gains. But a lot of that is really stimulated by the growth in non-European markets. Mm. It's the Asian, Latin American markets.
Still manufacturing is only, what, 10%? U.S. economy?
Yeah, it's a small percentage of the economy, but it's a very competitive one.
John Sylvia, thank you so much.
Listen to Bloomberg Surveillance weekday mornings at 7 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.